WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. That's the Aware Show, Fridays at 9 a.m. Thank you so very much for tuning in. And it's 10 o'clock, and a very special program is coming up, so please do stay tuned. And someone that I know rather well and have been, I would say, a friend, certainly a comrade of his over the years, and person wandered into the studio, and he is here now, and I am looking forward to him, and he will be on in just a moment. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is Christian McBride, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now, even when things go wrong, better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong if you start off each day with a song. You've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them, a million of them. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft, soft, a little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him, and without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved, and the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal, hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and their kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
If you start off each day with a song.
Well, his name is Jimmy Durante. My name is David Rothenberg, and that's my theme song when I open on Saturday mornings, which I will tomorrow. But I'm filling in for James Irsay today while BAI was, we can't call it a sabbatical, while BAI was away for 29 days. Mr. Irsay found other employment and hasn't broken off with me. I haven't talked to James, but I was told that somebody is going to fill in this spot, and that he is still going to be affiliated with WBAI, but his current situation does not allow him to be in on Friday morning. So here I am with you for the next 2 hours today, and I will be with you on the morrow, much earlier. And what I'm going to do today, besides having a guest and jabber about all the things that have irritated me and thrilled me and enriched me in the last 29 days, I'm also going to tell you about some theater tickets that we have. That's what we do on Saturday morning. It's a way of supporting BAI in a painless manner. I tell you about shows that are playing on Broadway and off Broadway, give them to you at very attractive prices, and it's a way of, do I have to convince you now of WBAI's economic plight? So before I even start kvetching about all the things that are kvetchable, I'm going to tell you about the first show for which we have tickets. And what I'm going to do is read you the review I gave it when it opened at Lincoln Center a month ago. Robert Schenken's political pageant, The Great Society, is igniting the Vivian Beaumont Theater at Lincoln Center. Living through the 1960s was at once exhilarating, treacherous, and informative, and the audacious Mr. Schenken, he a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, by the way, has miraculously recaptured the conflicts of that volatile decade, all of which continues to resonate today. At the center of the drama is Lyndon Baines Johnson, played with appropriate bombast by Brian Cox, for whom history dealt a full deck. The jury's still out on Lyndon Johnson's place in American history. LBJ succeeded the assassinated John F. Kennedy, and he inherited two major conflicts, the emerging civil rights movement and the combative anti-war skirmishes on the streets of our cities and towns, protesting the feudal war in Vietnam. Director Bill Rausch has performed a Herculean task in unveiling the playwright's patch quilt drama with overlapping scenes and historic histrionics. No doubt there will be ponderous analysis comparing the larger-than-life Lyndon Johnson with the current occupant of the White House. But let me note the difference. Lyndon Johnson inherited the social change. His years as a senator did not totally prepare him for the 1960s, as that became a decade of turmoil. While in Congress, LBJ was expert in pulling opposing forces together, achieving reasonable compromises. Trump, on the other hand, is the designer of the nation's conflict and lacks LBJ's political gifts of bringing people together. In fact, Trump plays a different role, polarizing the participants in political battle. But the play, The Great Society's significance as a theater piece and as historic drama, is its ability to mirror a vital slice of American history. And the men, and I say men because few women were at the center back then of political machinations, but the men who shaped the nation. And in the play, the characters include Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, Richard Nixon, Stokely Carmichael, General Westmoreland, Robert McNamara, a huge cast. I may add that Richard Thomas, who you may know as John Boy from the Waltons, now quite a mature man, is playing Richard Nixon. No, is Hubert Humphrey is who he plays. Interesting. And there are many others, all seen in the interactions with LBJ. Mr. Schenken, the playwright, sees JFK as a shadow in the 1960s, a curious departure from most historic annals. Theater plays many roles in American culture, one of which is to explore and rediscover our political and social heritage. And The Great Society succeeds expertly in that framework. And it's interesting to note that amidst all the political bombast and posturing demonstrated, one of the most chilling moments in the play is when a young African-American male, slain in a civil rights demonstration, and a voice that's barely audible, comes into LBJ's Oval Office and whispers in his ear, "I'm Jimmie Lee Jackson, and I'm dead." There are many notes in a theater offering, and sometimes a whisper has the impact of an explosion. The play is called The Great Society. It's at the Vivian Beaumont Theater in the beautiful theater at Lincoln Center. And we have tickets for WBAI listeners. If you pledge $100 this morning between now and 12 o'clock, You can get a pair of tickets this Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday night at 7 o'clock. We have some folks out here, special number, pencil and paper class. The number is 212-209-2950. That's the number just for theater tickets. Nothing else. We don't want to hear your complaints or your premiums that weren't delivered from 11 years ago. Just for theater tickets. 212-209-2950 to see the Great Society at Lincoln Center, the Vivian Beaumont Theater. Here's Nancy Lomat, who's going to kick off our musical cavalcade this morning, and then we'll have something to say about the last 29 days at WBAI, or that wasn't at WBAI. Miss Nancy Lomat with a Irving Berlin ballad.
Taking stock of what I have and what I haven't, what do I find? The things I've got will keep me satisfied. Checking up on what I have and what I haven't, what do I find? A healthy balance on the credit side. Got no diamond, got no pearl, still I think I'm a lucky girl. I got the sun in the morning and the moon at night. Got no mansion, got no yacht, still I'm happy with what I've got. I've got the sun in the morning and the moon at night. Sunshine gives me a lovely day. Moonlight gives me the Milky Way. Got no checkbook, got no banks, still I'd like to express my thanks. I got the sun in the morning and the moon at night. And with the sun in the morning and the moon in the evening, I'm all right. Got no butler, no maid, still I think I've been overpaid. I got the sun in the morning and the moon at night. Got no silver, got no gold, what I got can't be bought or sold. I got the sun in the morning and the moon at night. Sunshine gives me a lovely day. Moonlight gives me the Milky Way. Got no heirlooms for my kin, made no will, but when I cash in, I leave the sun in the morning and the moon at night. And with the sun in the morning and the moon in the evening, I'm all right. Got no diamond, got no pearl, still I think I'm a lucky girl. I got the sun in the morning and the moon at night. Got no mansion, got no yacht, still I'm happy with what I've got. I've got the sun in the morning and the moon at night. Got no silver, got no gold, what I got can't be bought or sold. I got the sun in the morning and the moon at night. Sunshine gives me a lovely day. Moonlight gives me the Milky Way. Sunshine, morning sunshine, moonlight.
The luscious Nancy Lomat with some pinter pauses in the middle of Irving Berlin's beautiful song that's reflective of today, which is sunny and beautiful and crisp. Summer's over, kids. And I just learned that the name of the show today is Any Saturday. No, Any Friday. Tomorrow's Any Saturday. The name of my show on Saturdays is Any Saturday. And listen, people kept emailing all of us, what can we do? How can we help EAI? What has to be done? Money. It's not that very complicated. So you can call in this morning, or at least in the next 2 hours. We have three folks answering phones. And earlier we said that we have tickets at Lincoln Center for the Vivian Beaumont for the play about LBJ by Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Robert Shankin, The Great Society. Tickets all this week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday night at 7 o'clock if you pledge $100. Or you can just call in and say, I want to give money because I want to make sure BAI is shielded from outside forces. And that number is 212-209-2950. We expect to hear the phones tinkling. So what happened the last 29 days? You've heard all sorts of if you're a insistent WBAI listener, and there seem to be many, if my emails count for anything. Now, what I'm about to tell you is all conjecture on my part. It's all alleged, because I don't know the person involved. The man, the central figure in this drama is John Vermeil. He was appointed about 4 months ago to the acting executive director, whatever the title was, of Pacifica. That sounds like a Trump cabinet appointment, an acting secretary of whatever. My first awareness of this man, about whom I know nothing, was that I came in one Saturday morning to do the show, and there was an edict that we were not allowed to be critical of candidates for president. And we were told that this was prompted because Mimi Rosenberg, who hosts a program on the station, had the temerity to be critical of Donald Trump, who's the presumed president of the United States. And she was threatened with being banned from the station. Is that an accurate description? And I thought, well, that's very un-BAI-ish. I did know that there were certain rules about candidates. I said, Trump is not an announced candidate yet, so you can say what you want. But you can say what you want about any candidate. The rule that I remember from FCC is that if you have a candidate on your program as a guest, invitations have to be sent to the other candidates running against him or her. But I never heard anything. Fox would be out of business. So would CNN. Why BAI? That was my introduction to John Vermeil. Then the next thing I heard is that he came in the middle of the night. Was it middle of the night, Michael? Or early. How early?
8 o'clock.
That's middle of the night. 8 o'clock is middle of the night. And he came in with two men, and they took over the station. Subsequent, saying that Pacific was taking it over, and that the reason was that BAI had money problems. Well, what's new? Everybody's having money problems, and Pacifica stations particularly. We don't have sponsors. We're known for our excessive political and social action and commentary, which doesn't bring in money from the Koch brothers. And even George Sporos hasn't sent a dollar this way. So that we struggle. That's part of the nobility of the struggle, I guess, is that you're always at the edge. And they were going to take it over and rumored to sell it because the middle of the FM dial in New York area could bring in a lot of money, although of decreasing value, and that money would then go to the other Pacifica stations, which also are having financial difficulty. It's called throwing one of your brothers under the bus. But I thought that that there was a hidden agenda there. And this is all conjecture, as I said. I have no evidence. I don't know John Vermeil. The coming in at the middle of the night at 8 o'clock in the morning and taking over a station is very Roger Stone-ish, political dirty trickish. It sounded to me like an attempt to silence a never-Trump voice. And so I've been asking people, who is John Vermeil? What's his background? Does he know Roger Stone? Does he have any contacts with the political right that would have reason to silence an outspoken voice in the upcoming political campaign that's being faced. I don't know the answer to that. I do know that I kept hearing that when this court thing was being dragged and Arthur Schwartz doing noble work for WBAI, being paid about $1.95, was confronting with a team of Wall Street lawyers. They don't come in cheap. So who's putting up the money for them? Is it a struggling Pacifica network that has its own financial difficulties? Is it the West Coast stations that don't have the money? Is John Vermeil a man with deep pockets? And I'm told he lives in Westchester, and yet headquarters out of California. Who is he? Where did he come from? What's the agenda? I don't know. I truly don't know. But those are questions to be asked. Is this a political... is this a Roger Stone type of gimmick? Roger has his own problems this week, and after we hear an encore version from Nancy Lamont, we'll talk about Roger's little episode, that's little opus that's happening in Washington as we talk, and which has a little bit of a BAI connection, and I'll fill you in on all of that. Nancy Lamont.
So many things we can't control, so many hurts that happen every day, so many heartaches that pierce the soul, so much pain that won't ever go away. How do we make it better? How do we make it through? What can we do when there's nothing we can do? We can be kind. We can take care of each other. We can remember that deep down inside we all need the same thing. And maybe we'll find, if we are there for each other, that together we'll weather whatever tomorrow may bring. Nobody really wants to fight. Nobody really wants to go to war. If everyone wants to make things right, then what are we always fighting for? Does nobody want to see it? Does nobody understand? The power to heal is right here in our hand. We can be. We can remember that deep down inside we all need the same thing. And maybe we'll find, if we are there for each other, that together we'll weather whatever tomorrow may bring. Sing a song. We must walk the walk about it. You and I, do or die. We've got to try to get along. We can be kind. We can take care of each other. Together we'll weather whatever tomorrow may bring.
Beautiful sound of Nancy Lamott. That's a David Friedman song. He wrote many of the songs for Nancy Lamott, and we'll be hearing more from them as the morning proceeds. When I was checking on the if calls were coming in, and they are for the theater tickets, and yes, people calling to support BAI. If you get a busy signal, there are only three phones out there. I hope we have more tomorrow. Berthold, if you're listening, because all three were going, and so if you're calling in and you got a busy signal, call back. And before I discuss the Roger Stone trial, let me I want to fill you in that before the coup took place, we had Malachy McCourt and myself had planned a fundraising event, which we did up at the castle, at the Fortune Society Castle Gardens, called Conversations with Malachy and David. Two old codgers sitting around discussing. And, you know, once the coup took place, we said, well, we won't have a radio broadcast to sell it. And we used all that modern technology, which I don't understand. For those of you who are not familiar with my Saturday morning programs, let me fill you in on something. The only machine I have conquered is my toaster. I don't know from computers or microwaves or vacuum cleaners. I'm electronically an imbecile. But people who know me and know Malachy sent out emails and went on some, what's it called, Michael? Facebook. And we had a full house at the Castle Gardens last Sunday. And I had a wonderful time because I find Malachy not only wise and older than me, but funny. And we made some money for BAI. It was a joint thing for BAI and Fortune. So we got together the other day when the coup ended and said, well, why don't we do it again? And we'll do it at the Commons so that BAI people can learn about it because we're back on the air. So Malachy and I are going to do an encore by popular indifference. No, by popular demand. We're going to do on Sunday, December 8th. And I'm telling you early because in case there's another coup, you will have already gotten your tickets. So on Sunday, November 8th at 2 o'clock, Malachy McCourt and David Rothenberg are going to do Conversations. And we will not be repeating what we did. Let me just tell you this. It's $25 a person, and I'll give you the number and all that. What we did is we took five subjects. And we did 15 minutes on each. The first word was on movies, plays, and books that shaped our lives. The second was on living and dying. Malachy wrote a book about dying. He's so funny on the subject. The third topic we did was if we were running for president, what would be our signature issue? The fourth topic was impeachment. And the fifth was WBAI. Well, we had a great time. And the audience was so responsive, and they took pictures afterwards. I don't know what they're going to do with them, with their little phones. Everybody was taking pictures. Wherever I went for 3 days, people said, oh, I have a picture of you. Where did they come from? How did they get there? But we had a good time. We had a full house. And so we're going to do it again. And I'm telling you now, Sunday, December 8th, what did Malachy say we should call it? An atheist mass, because it's during the Christmas season. So it's $25 a person, Sunday, December 8th, 2 o'clock. Call right now, 212-209-2950. Now, the trial in let's just start off with this. In the New York Times today, the editorial is titled The Roger Stone Trial and Mr. Trump. The lead sentence says, Roger Stone, a longtime confidant of Donald Trump, is an inveterate liar, a self-proclaimed dirty trickster. Not even his legal team disputes this. Now, the main witness yesterday and his pictures in the New York Times today in a story is our old friend, Randy Credico. Randy, who is Randy is an old friend of mine, and we've been at odds. And Randy, if you're not listening, I know because I mentioned him last Sunday, and he immediately was responding to it. So somebody will call him and say, Rothenberg said this about you. I think Randy's funny and talented, and his heart in the right place. And I think he made some terrible choices, but he can support and do whatever he wants. What I had problems with Randy was during the 2016 election, before the election, my program was on from 8 to 10, and Randy was on an hour before me, and he had Roger Stone on as a guest 7 weeks in a row. And after the first program, I said, why are you having Roger Stone? I didn't know that Randy had a 20-year association with Roger Stone. And the answer was, oh, BAI always has unpopular or far-out guests. We've had Madeline Murray O'Hare, and we've had William Buckley. I said, that's different than having Roger Stone during a campaign who's doing dirty tricks about one of the candidates, who in this case, in this time, was Hillary Clinton. And he was clearly working for Donald Trump. And Randy's argument always was, I'm supporting Jill Stein. Well, you may be supporting Jill Stein, but if at the end of every program, he'd say to me, oh, wait till you hear what we have next week. And he, in fact, went to London. It was Randy who interviewed Julian Assange, according to at least what he told me. And so I was very concerned about, not that Randy doesn't have the right. He could support Trump, or he could support Jill Stein, or he could do whatever he wants to hurt Hillary's campaign. My concern was WBAI. BAI should not, is a progressive radio station and shouldn't be used to undermine progressive ideals. And I saw it as if I can make an analogy, it's like, of a parent seeing their child dating somebody who they think is going to be damaging to them. Does that make sense? Is that paternalistic of me? Somebody might say that. I was concerned about BAI being a role. Now, in the story today in the Times and all the stories, they say a radio host. Blessedly, they're not saying WBAI. But he was using the station for Roger Stone. Gehring and Goebbels were not available. That's Roger Stone has, since Nixon, has been a blight on the political discourse in our country. And I was upset that Randy was using this station to allow that voice to be heard. Then when he announced that he was running for the board of WBAI and flyers went out and he was the number one candidate on the slate, I broke a BAI cardinal rule. You're not allowed to mention internal politics. And I said, why is Randy running as a board member after being associated with Roger Stone? And I was vilified, and some of the people on his slate came on the air, and that's all water under the bridge. My position on all of this is, Randy, you can support Jill Stein, and you can help Roger Stone create fictions or find dirt about Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden or whatever Roger Stone does. But not on this station. That's not what BAI should be and can't be used for. Have I gotten it all out? At the trial yesterday, he apparently, during the testimony, did one of his impressions of Bernie Sanders. And the judge said this is, let me read from the Times what it says so I won't be misquoted. Mr. Credico described a long, rocky relationship. At another point, he broke into a brief, convincing impression of Senator Bernie Sanders, the Democratic presidential candidate. We know you're a comedian, but this is serious business, the judge chided him. Randy may get work out of all this. He's getting so much attention for his impressions. He told John McDonough, who drove him to the airport, to the train station, that he might talk like Giuliani. He does a great Giuliani. Randy, I'm concerned for your safety. I'm concerned for your well-being. I'm unhappy that you're involved in all of this. I know that you've hidden yourself. I just wish you didn't bring BAI into it. And as far as Roger Stone is concerned, I'll dance at that perp walk if he gets convicted. And I'm not a great fan of people being incarcerated, for those who know me. But I'll tell you, if there's a perp walk with Donald Trump, I'll sell tickets and use the money to support BAI. How's that grab you? Here's Bobby McFerrin with a musical interlude, and we'll cover some other issues. Bobby McFerrin, my better half. I'm David Rothenberg, filling in for James Irsay. I'll be here till 12. That's high noon, without Gary Cooper. We're raising money for BAI. You may have heard that BAI was, what's the word? It was a coup. We were couped out for 29 days, and one of the big issues was our financial weak. What's the word that I want to use here? The fact that we are financially in difficulty, and they took advantage of that. The coup people did. So we're inviting you to call us at 212-209-2950 and help us remain on the air. I'm trying to make it a little easier for you by saying that you can see the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Robert Schenken's play, The Great Society, which is at Lincoln Center, the Vivian Beaumont Theater, Brian Cox playing Lyndon Baines Johnson, and in this enormous cast. I failed to mention in my review earlier, Grantham Coleman as Martin Luther King. At first look, it's not Martin Luther King, but he conveys it. That's what good acting is, and it's a stunning performance. And it's a real audience crowd pleaser because it's about, and it's a BAI play. Need I say that it's about the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement and how Lyndon Johnson was caught up in this trap. And it's rich, good theater. It's called The Great Society. It's at Lincoln Center at the Vivian Beaumont Theater, which in itself is a treat. And we have tickets for this week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday night. If you give $100 to WBAI, you get two tickets if you call us at 212-209-2950. Or just call that number and say, I want to support BAI because I realize while you were not on the air, we missed you. And it's my time to report to you that on Monday, on Veterans Day, Donald Trump has announced he's going to be around Madison Square Park. And I think he might hear some boos. This will not be a choreographed rally like he's learned in Diddly-Poo, Georgia, and Bigotown, Mississippi. This is going to be the real people. He's going to get the whole message. Now, there's a special section for him. It's called for Veterans Day. It's for people who have had five draft deferments for a bone chip. And I say that. Here's a sentence that I say that can usually stops the conversation. It's when I say, well, when I was in the Army, and people stop, and you? Yep. 2 years. Never left Fort Benning, Georgia. They wouldn't let me. They found out that I had been editor of my college paper, and after 8 weeks of basic training, 8 weeks of advanced training, when I learned how to bomb, to destroy a tank, become a machine gunner, and use a bazooka, I don't know if any of those things are used anymore, I was put in the general's office to write his speeches. And then they, because they found out that I had been at, I filled out that I had been on the college paper. So here I am with, I felt like a traitor to everything I believed in. Then they made me the editor of the 3rd Division newspaper, which was called the Marne, which was the river in France in which the 3rd Division shined so brightly during World War I. And when the 3rd Division went overseas, and I thought, I'm going to go to Europe, they switched me to the main post and made me editor of a paper called The Bayonet. And there I was. And guess who my immediate officer was? It was Special Services. He was there for 6 months, an ROTC lieutenant, and his name was Jim Brown. He was a pro football player from the Cleveland Browns, and during the off season, he came in. And I'll tell you something. You know, Jim Brown, if you followed his career, became very active on the West Coast on prison reform. And about 3 years ago, he came to a Fortune Society, and he was in town, and somebody invited him. So everybody had heard my story, and the story I'm about to tell you. I walked over and I said, Jim Brown? He said, yes. And I said, David Rothenberg, Fort Benning, Georgia. And he looked at me and I said, we went on a track trip together. You were the officer. And he said, oh, that was you. And I said, yes. He was running for Fort Benning and I was covering it for the Bayonet. And Jim, we had gotten friendly. He wasn't much like an officer to me. He was, you know, a guy there. And he drove up in his car and I went with him. And so they put us, officer and enlisted man, in a barracks thing together. And he had the upper bunk and I had the lower bunk. And I went to bed and he came in late and stepped on me. Now, Jim Brown was 6'3", 220. And he said, what is that? I'm gasping for breath. So when I see him 40 years later, I said, you stepped on me. I said, you did that to defense players all over the league, but they got big bucks, right? He said, that was you. And he embraced me and he remembered it. And that's the story I would tell Donald Trump, four-time draft deferment for his bone trip, when he comes to tell the veterans on Monday at the park. Well, that's a whole other story. We also have tickets we're making available to you for conversations with Malachi McCourt and David Rothenberg, an encore presentation Sunday, December 8th at 2 o'clock at the Commons, which is right below the Crystal Studios of WBAI, over 388 Atlantic Avenue. Is that where we are? So we had a great time last Sunday, Malachi and myself. I don't know if the audience seemed to have a good time, but we had a wonderful time together. And we're going to do it again because we filled up the house and we thought maybe some more BAI people now that we're back on the air would want to know about it. So if you want to plan ahead, I know it's a month away, but time goes by quickly. Here's Nancy Wilson. I hate saying this. The late Nancy Wilson. I worked with Nancy Wilson when she was a young singer. I was representing the O'Keeffe Center in Toronto, and I was there for the summer, and she came up, not that well known then, and she was lovely and sweet-voiced, and I had a nice couple of weeks just hanging with her, and never saw her again, but was thrilled to have had that moment or that fortnight with Nancy Wilson. Here she is with a beautiful song called Send Me Yesterday.
Out of the tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything starting to hum. Still, it's a real good bet, the best is yet to come. The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? You think you've seen the sun, but you ain't seen it shine. Wait till the warm-up's underway. Wait till our lips have met. Wait till you see that sunshine day. You ain't seen nothing yet. The best is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? The best is yet to come, come the day you're mine. Come the day you're mine, I'm gonna teach you to fly. We've only tasted the wine, we're gonna drain the cup dry. Wait till your child. Is yet to come, and babe, won't it be fine? The best is yet to come, come the day you're mine.
Nancy Wilson, David Rothenberg. I have something happened last night. It was a rather poignant story. I go every Thursday night to the Fortune Academy, the castle. It's where the Fortune Society has their weekly community meeting with the residents of the castle. It's 75, 80 men and women, formerly incarcerated, homeless, who have come. And it's become a model community. And people from all over the country come to the castle to see an alternative kind of program and residence that's so different. Over the years, I have gone to halfway houses, and this is not a halfway house, around the country, and they're usually run by probation or parole or by the Department of Correction, and you feel the tenseness as you go in. Not at the castle. It's quite different. And about a month ago, the head of correction from the state of Pennsylvania came and visited and said, this is what we should be doing. This is the atmosphere that we should have. How do we create this? And in the following 3 weeks, every Thursday for the last 3 weeks, a half a dozen people from Pennsylvania, his administrative staff and wardens and correction people from different institutions have been coming to visit the main office at Fortune Society in Long Island City and spending Thursday at the community meetings. And I saw three men standing there, and I said, hi, how are you? And I said, Pennsylvania? And one guy said, yeah, I'm from Duquesne. And another said, I'm helping setting up a program with the Department of Correction. And the third man said to me, hello, my name is John Weidman. And I said, the author. And he said, yes. And I said, I interviewed you on WBAI over 30 years ago with a book you wrote about your brother. And he said, yes, you did. And I said, the book was Brothers and Keepers. And he said, that's it. And I said, let me try and remember, because I remember the reason I wanted to interview you is because it was so poignant. And as I recalled, and as I told John Weidman, that the book was about, he was a professor in college, and his brother was doing life in prison. And the book was about how did two young men from the same family have such diverse, how did they have such different parts? How did their life go so far apart? And he had stayed closely in touch with his brother and tried to be supportive of him, visiting him and writing him and staying in touch with him during his imprisonment. But it was a beautifully written book about family, about love, about brothers, and about the things in society that drive you apart. And then he said to me, the second man who I met, whose name I think was Farouk, and he said, that's my brother. And I said, you're out. And he said, yes, he had made parole. And it was so emotional because I had remembered the impact. I said, John, didn't your book win the National Book Award? He said, it was a finalist. And I said, well, it should have won. And he said, well, it's still published and it's being read in classrooms. It's a beautiful book. It's in paperback. If you're looking for a good, emotional, intelligent read, Brothers and Keepers by John Weidman, I couldn't recommend it more highly. So they then came in and they sat through the meeting. And at the end, we introduced them and asked if they had anything to say. And John said, I can't get over the fact that we were here for about an hour eating and walking around and looking at the facilities. And everybody that came by, every resident, every staff person said, hi, how are you? And introduced themselves. He said, you know how unusual that is? And he complimented the residents. He said, you don't find that in correctional facilities or halfway houses. And he said, something exciting is happening here. And for me, it was so poignant because I immediately remembered it was a 35 years ago on BAI that I first interviewed him, having read his book. And we've both gotten a little bit older since then. But It was very nice, it made me feel good to have that exchange with him. So, do I make another pitch? This is WBAI, 99.5 listener-sponsored radio, and you're one of the listeners, and we hope you'll sponsor us. We've been off the air for most of the month of October because some naughty people came in and said, "This is ours." And we went into court and we found out, no, it's not theirs, it's ours. And that the listeners have an important part to play. And I received so many, I was so touched by the emails. I love the email of a woman said, I don't know what movies to see unless you tell me. So I want to tell you, if you're listening, I saw so many movies in the last 29 days. Some of them you already know about, and I'll go into them a little later. Harriet, Ed Norton's movie Motherless Brooklyn, and Scorsese's masterpiece The Irishman. But there's a movie down at the Film Forum that got a great review in the Times, buried deep in, and was overlooked. And I want to call it to your attention. It's called By the Grace of God. It's a French film. The French filmmaker François Ozon, you like my French? I described it as brilliant and provocative new movie. and will be, I think, should be clearly at the forefront when the foreign movie award season begins. And more than that, it would be the starting juncture for debates, essays, probing, self-exploration about religion, faith, sex, child exploitation, and in sundry other emotional conditions in the human experience. Briefly, the film taken from the and this is taken from the press release, is based on the gripping true story of three adult men in France who banded together to expose the code of silence in the church that continued to empower a priest who had abused them as boys. And to say that the movie is riveting is an understatement. It is emotionally all-consuming. Much of the content is the betrayal that men, these men experience, devoted to their church and idolizing Jesus, who and the priest who performed the saintly duties. My mind was all over the place during the showing of the movie. The church and the Catholic Church and much of religious orthodoxy is anti-sexual. So when a church leader imposes his sexual needs on a child, and these were not these were boys 12 and 13, difficult age in which to impose that, his sexual needs on a child, even if not physically harmful, it could be devastating to the psyche. And men in the movie revealed lifetime damage of varying degrees. In addition to all the obvious injuries caused by pedophilia, children who are not yet able to make mature decisions, lured into sexual situations by adults, they are victims because their reasoning and their control of their lives is limited. Of course, this extends beyond priests and with choir boys and Cub Scouts. It includes betrayal and invasion by family members, neighbors, teachers, in the home and in the school. I always recall a friend telling me that as a child in Catholic school, the nuns routinely and repeatedly told the girls that sex was vile, dirty, repugnant, and dangerous. Fill in the blank space of your own word of horror. Then the church teacher would add, so save that honor for the man you love, who you will marry. So the young woman told, it's disgusting, it's vile, it's dirty, save it for the man you love. Talk about your mixed messages. I began wondering during the screening of By the Grace of God if it was the sex act or the distorted view of sex that was instilled, that is, and that's not to make a defense of pedophilia, which is about power and control and the absence of options. But if we begin to talk about early sexual experimentation with peers, it usually begins in the early teens, mostly ill-informed children having furtive, clumsy sex with each other. Boys are drilled to be assertive and to score. Girls often wanting to be accepted and love, acquiesce, even after enduring warnings about pregnancy and disease. That it's a more prevailing power play, but adults are not involved, even when adults are not involved. So no legal, even though legal barriers are not violated unless the boy is 17 and the girl is 16, then it's statutory rape. Of course, I'm reflecting on my own long-ago childhood, aware that teens today are exposed to much more open discussions. But as I view the sexual titillation and much of the musical videos that I see directed at the post-pubescent market, I'm not sure if the explicit aspects of sexuality represents maturity and understanding or adds to the dialogue about sexual conquests and entitlement. Anyway, all of that came from my seeing this movie. It's at the Film Forum. It's called By the Grace of God. And here's Jose Feliciano, and hopefully we'll find our guest as Jose's singing.
Discouraged, the man he ain't so hard to understand. Chico, if you try now, I know that you can lend a helping hand. cause it's good in everyone, and a new day has begun. You can see the morning sun if you try, and I know things will be better. Trust you. He thinks you're trying to bust up all his dreams. But man, he don't know now that you've got your own crazy plans and schemes. Well, there's good in everyone, and a new day has begun. You can see the morning sun if you try. Things will be better. Oh, yes, they will. For Chico and the man. Yes, they will. For Chico and the man. Even though it's funny, he don't understand. Yeah. Oye, me Chico, Chico. Vamos al vacilón. Mira, caminando por la calle de Los Ángeles. Chico, te encuentras solo. Oye, chico, vamos a vacilar, vamos a vacilar. Oye, que yo me voy, que yo me voy, que yo me voy.
That's Jose Feliciano, Chico and the Man. And on the phone with us, hopefully, is Susan Lampert Haydom. Are you with us?
I am.
Good morning. And you've written a play that opens this week, and I must say I was intrigued by it, and I talked to several people, and I feel, and they looked at me askance because I said, what was, I don't know what Jimmy Carter's confidence speech was, and they said, I'm old enough, and they said, you don't remember. So this is the thrust of your play. Can you fill me in historically on what Jimmy Carter did and why it lends itself to theater?
Certainly. So 40 years ago, in a really hot summer at a really crisis time in our country, on July 4th, 1979, President Carter canceled an important energy speech he was supposed to give the next day. And he disappeared to Camp David. And 10 days later, he emerged and gave a new speech called the Crisis of Confidence speech. And
Why don't I remember this?
Here's the thing. So it was considered fairly unprecedented. It had great response initially, but then later it was sort of used against him. It was known as the malaise speech, became known as the malaise speech. And Reagan used it against him when he ran for office. And so some people now look back and say that the speech was fairly farsighted because he was talking about getting off foreign oil, and he was talking about, you know, basically moving to renewable energy. And he was also talking, though, about a crisis of confidence in the nation. He was actually speaking to the soul of the nation and saying that we were sort of headed down a wrong path as a country, and we needed to sort of regroup and refine our confidence again as citizens. So that was an interesting speech to me, but the 10 days that he disappeared and had this sort of impromptu domestic summit and brought in all these religious leaders and economic leaders and governors and Congress people, and like he was searching for how to speak to America and how to speak to what he felt was sort of a crisis that we were having on really a sort of national soul level.
Can you imagine what he would have to say now?
I know.
and that's probably why,
fascinating to me.
And well, that's probably that content, as you describe it, makes it so pertinent today. But then how do you shape that? You're calling the play is called Confidence, Land of the Speech, and the Speech, Confidence and the Speech. How do you take that experience that Jimmy Carter, a president disappearing. I can't imagine that happening now. How does that shape into a play?
Well, so I was fascinated by that time, and I was looking at it, and for me, I actually wanted to look at it from a modern, I realized I was looking at it from a modern kind of feminist perspective, looking back at the speech. And I was like, that's what it's really about. Because it's, to me, this play, ultimately, I wanted to explore basically a nation in crisis, a president that was trying to do the right thing for the country and risking his presidency. And but I also wanted to, I had something to say about women in politics, oddly enough, and you'd think, how could that possibly be said in this? Carter had an impressive presidency. I think it's under-examined, his presidency. He put more women and more people of color into his administration than had ever happened before. He ran on a platform of civil rights and women's rights. He was a huge supporter of the Equal Rights Amendment and really, really tried to get that passed during his administration. And that, and to me, I think some of the reason that his presidency is looked at as sort of was weak or ineffectual was actually because he was a different kind of president. He was a listening president. He was a nurturing president. And so to me, it felt like it was kind of the first feminist presidency in a lot of ways. And so I wanted to look back at the speech from that point of view. So I start actually in modern times with another nation in crisis. But ultimately, I start with a college professor. And so I imagine a new person into this situation who was there. And so it's both a historical document, but it starts with a completely imagined scenario that there was a young woman intern in the Carter White House during that time. And this young man approaches his college professor in modern times. She's like 60 years old and after her class and wants to know about her time with the Carter administration during those 10 days. And she's like, that was a long time ago. If you want to know the story of my story, I'm going to play the president and you're going to play me. And so for the flashback to 1979 in the play, this older college professor plays President Carter, this woman plays President Carter, and the young man that wants to know her story of the speech plays her as a young female intern in Carter's White House. So it ends up becoming about who gets to speak up in a room, how do you make your voice heard, how do you find the confidence to speak up, and what it takes to be in politics, and what it looks like to sort of have a female president. Under the guise of talking about this other thing that a president was trying to do. So it's a very layered play.
Does it take place while he's conjecturing in those 10 days at Camp David, or is it the majority of it?
The majority of the play takes place during those 10 days, but it's bookended by basically modern times and the story of this older woman and what her story is, and this imagined woman in the Carter administration.
Had you been a historian interested in the Carter presidency, or did this come to you reading or studying that you suddenly saw the dramatic possibilities in it?
Well, I grew up in Georgia, and so I was a kid when Carter was first our governor and been president, and so I was sort of fascinated by, you know, him. He spoke in a way that that resonated with me as a young woman growing up in the 70s and 80s. And so so I actually was reading about him and his presidency, and I'm a kind of a huge fan of sort of political theater and political movies and plays, you know, All the Way, West Wing, and as well as sort of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. I love that stuff. And so I was really fascinated by Carter, and I was reading, and I read a paragraph about this thing that happened, these 10, I was like, wow, those 10 days, I thought that would be a play. And so I went down to Plains, Georgia. I was home for Thanksgiving, and I took my whole family down to Plains, Georgia to see President Carter speak. He teaches Sunday school, many Sundays at his church in Plains, Georgia, and I was just fascinated. I thought he...
Did you talk to him?
I wanted... I did. I met him.
He's
I didn't
about
really
93
talk to him.
Now?
Him. Yeah, he was about 89 when I was down there.
Yeah.
So it was right when I was starting to write the play. And I thought, I want to do this. And then it just became a really interesting... Like, for me, I love Aaron Sorkin's writing. I love Robert Schenken. I love... those writers, and I was sort of, it's sort of a emulation of that, but from my perspective.
You picked two good ones.
Sort of, yeah.
Earlier we were talking about Schenken's play, The Great Society, so that the influence.
I'm going to see it this week. I can't wait.
Well, you should call when you can get tickets through WBAI. We're making them available.
Okay.
I'm very curious about something you said a little earlier about... And it's occurred to me, he was defeated. He had one term. He was defeated by Reagan. And we read so much, political historians constantly refer to Reagan, good, bad, or indifferent. He's a factor. You don't get, and same with LBJ and JFK. Carter's more than any president in my lifetime is almost overlooked. He's not in the discussion.
I agree. And I think he should be. I think there is no Obama presidency without the Carter presidency. I think he did so many things. Stuart Eisenstadt, who was in his administration, just wrote a book about a year and a half ago that basically is reexamining the Carter administration and saying it was in some ways one of the most effective 4 years of a presidency. He started the Department of Energy. He started the Department of Education. He got he complied with the Panama Canal Treaty, which was very damaging to him politically, but basically
Why?
Saved.
Why was
us
that damaging?
It was supposed to happen, and nobody wanted to have it because it felt like America was giving up something, even though they really were never supposed to have it. Right. So so a lot of people politically at the time felt like, oh, America is giving up some property that we own, rather than we're honoring the treaty that we, you know, had with these countries. And so it really helped to stabilize that part of the country, because we basically were able to not end up in a war trying to defend a treaty that we were going to break.
Certainly. So, and we're talking to Susan Lambert Hayden, whose play Confidence and the Speech starts previews this Thursday on Theater Row. The thing that you said that is in today, look, the perspective of a president making a crisis of confidence speech, and from the way you described it, he was talking about our moral, our morality, our values, something that doesn't enter into the dialogue in the Oval Office. I don't even think they would know what we're talking about.
There is a little bit of it ends up commenting a lot on what the presidency is or should be. And that ultimately ended up being, I'd almost finished the play in 2016, and then the 2016 happened, the election happened, and I didn't quite know what to do with the play. I kind of had to set it aside for about 3 months, and then...
And then Trump helped you.
Well, actually, no, the Women's March helped me.
Oh.
The Women's March was like, oh, no, I do have something to say that I think will resonate right now. And so that's... that I changed the ending, I did some different things, and so it ends up being an examination of what's happening now, as well as all these missed opportunities in American politics, but it ultimately is supposed to be a call to action and really be an inspiration for letting your voice be heard, for finding your confidence to, you know, step up and speak up and basically try to fix what's wrong, all of our many problems.
I would think, Susan?
Yes, of course.
I would think that a kid in high school or college reading about Jimmy Carter would be stunned by the notion of a president making political choices based on moral values. It seems it's evaporated, at least.
So I
think
I
wanted it was there with
it
Obama.
Back.
It was
I
there with Obama.
It was there with Obama. I totally think it was there with Obama, and I think we end up not. I think it's hard to appreciate that when we have it, because it feels so undramatic, right? It feels like, oh, of course they're doing the right thing. But are they doing enough of the right thing, right? Uh-huh. Then it becomes like this attack of, are you doing enough of the right thing? And he gave this speech, and it was a political minefield to give this speech. A lot of his administration thought that. Walter Mondale thought that, because he was basically saying, I've screwed up as a president. Our country is headed down the wrong path. This is I'm going to tell you the truth, and I'm going to give you a warning that if we don't examine this, if we don't fix all these problems in our, if we don't face ourselves as a country, as citizens, and step up, we're going to be headed down the wrong path. And he turned out to be an incredibly prescient speech. And it also it's a play about climate change. Climate change comes in there because it talks about sort of the discovery of information that we knew 40 years ago that we should have addressed. So it ends up using the speech as a metaphor for both Carter's presidency and examining Carter's presidency, but also what he was trying to do with the speech as a call to action that we should all step up and try to examine how we can move forward and how we can be inspired by moral presidents.
Why did he think he messed up as president? Was it the Iraq hostage crisis?
I would say I raise those questions in the play. I don't necessarily answer them in the play. I personally think that it was the Iran hostage crisis that ultimately basically made him lose.
Now, as I recall American history, and this, yes. I guess it's history we're talking about.
Is I know, the, 40 the, years ago.
The allegations from historians are that Reagan made a secret deal to that the crisis couldn't be resolved while Carter was president, so that it would help him. Is there any? Did that come in your research at all?
I did not really research that particular part. I really researched basically the months before that. So my research sort of ends in July 1979, and the Iran hostage crisis began later that year. But here's two things that I did read about it. One, there is some discussion that they timed in order to hurt Carter. They had already negotiated the release of the prisoners.
They being who? The Iranians?
They being the Carter administration, with help from Canada and a bunch of other intermediaries, had already basically negotiated the release.
Doesn't
the timing
Susan,
was
this
done
smacks
to
of,
hurt
this,
Carter.
This sounds like Ukraine now, doesn't it?
Well, again, and there's a lot, if you look at it, we keep playing the same music over and over again politically. We really do. We just have different players. So that's one of the things the speech is sort of speaking to. The speech and the play. I tried to speak to that. So, you know, because the other thing that happened is it turns out that without invading a country, without dropping a bomb, without losing, they did lose lives when they tried to do the rescue, but they lost one, you know, they basically tried to do this rescue of the hostage crisis, and they had basically, you know, a crashed helicopter that happens all the time in the military. But
isn't that Argo? Isn't the movie Argo about that?
Movie Argo is not about the rescue attempt. It was about there were other hostages that escaped during that they weren't hostages. They actually left the embassy and then were hiding elsewhere.
Yes.
They were in another embassy, I think the Canadian embassy, and they got them out. But here's the thing. They got out all the hostages. This is what happened under what Carter managed to do and what Mondale managed to do is get out all the hostages safely. It took a year without dropping a bomb, starting a war, or really having any of the hostages killed. It was a successful. He was successful. That's the, to me, the very most interesting part and why I wrote the speech, that we look at something and it seems like it's a failure, and it turns out it was actually a huge success. And so there were huge successes with the Carter administration that I think we don't see because we've decided that someone who loses an election is a failure, or that some
interesting,
that you know, and that to me is not really looking at history correctly.
Well, answer a question.
We're not learning the right lessons.
Answer a question for me, and it may not have anything to do with this time because my mind is all scrambled about history of that period. When did we intrude in Iran and put and Mossadegh was overthrown and we put the Shah in off our CIA?
That was before Carter. So the Shah was. So and again, I'm not an expert on this part of history. I like history, but I have to really research to be, so I can't really speak to that. But what started the Iran hostage crisis was the Shah was very old and had cancer and was dying, and he had left. He was unpopular, and the American administration, Carter and the administration, did not realize how unpopular he was, and he needed somewhere to basically get treatment, and the United States had treatment. So the United States let him into the country.
It's all connected.
He needed medical treatment. The United States let him into the country, and that made the people in Iran truly angry, and that helped start it. But again, he was all, you know, part of Carter's message was that he was trying to get across was we have to get out of the Middle East, or we have to be more involved in Middle East politics, and that is a problem, and we can't do that because it won't go well for us.
And it prevails today.
What
all the conflicts today go all the way back. Mossadegh was elected democratically. We imposed with the Shah, and then the hostage crisis. My mind's reeling. How peace? You know, the connections are all so startling.
Yes.
Huh.
Exactly.
Well, the play. You've taken a big chunk of history and putting it on the stage, and it sounds fascinating. I'm gonna call Richard Hillman and tell him I have to see it.
You have to come see it.
I want to now.
I think you'll be surprised. I think it will both intrigue and surprise you, and also like leave you with some hope and some new realizations about how we look at history.
And Jimmy Carter.
And Jimmy Carter for sure. So I'm excited for people to see the play.
I'm excited for you. The play is Confidence in the Speech. We're talking to the playwright, Susan Lambert Hadams. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, too.
Go to rehearsal.
And, glad you're back on the air.
Thank you. We are, too.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I want to let you know that, of course, I hustled some tickets for us when I read about the play. A preview start this week on Theater Row on West 42nd Street for Confidence in the Speech. And we have not that many, but tickets for Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night at 8 o'clock. $65 to BAI, and you get a pair of tickets. If you call us at 212-209-2950. Say it again, David. Somebody will say you said it so fast. 212-209-2950. And if you've been saying, how can I help? Here's how you can help. Go see this play. Pay $65 to BAI. You'll be enriched politically. We'll be enriched with your money. And everybody will have a wonderful time. And who do we have musically now? From the Broadway musical Swing. Is that it? Michael Haskins nodding yes. I expect to hear phones ringing at 212-209-2950. Phones don't ring anymore, by the way. They just go zzz. So I don't even know if it's ringing. But make a zzz sound. From the Broadway musical Swing. And this is the Gotham City something or others. It's a Duke Ellington and Count Basie combined writing this song.
What good is melody? What good is music if it ain't possessing something sweet? Ba-da-da-da-da-da-da. It ain't the melody, it ain't the music. There's something else that makes the song complete. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing.
do-wah-do-wah-do-wah-do-wah-do-wah-do-wah-do-wah-do-wah. It don't mean nothing. All you gotta do is sing.
Do-wah-do-wah-do-wah-do-wah-do-wah-do-wah-do-wah-do-wah.
Well, it make no difference if it's sweet or hot. Ba-da-da-da-da-da. Just give that rhythm everything you got. Bum-bum, it don't mean nothing if it ain't got that swing.
Do-wah-do-wah-do-wah-do-wah-do-wah-do-wah-do-wah.
I saw a swing, I think it was with Laura Beninati and Larry Hamilton. Am I, who was in the kit? Ann Hampton Callaway, Laura Beninati, and these guys, the Gotham City Gates. And I remember it was a matinee that I went and I took 15 teenagers from the Fortune Society. Now, these are kids who grew up on rap and all that music, and they loved it was as... They felt like they were Margaret Mead going to Samoa, a whole different culture. And I was telling them about Duke Ellington and Count Basie, and they didn't know who they were. And I yelled at them, and we had a terrific time at Swing. I'm going to do a play review and then tell you about how you can support us. You all threatened that you were going to support us while we were crying that money was the factor. Here's a play, though. It's reviewed in the Times and the News today, and you're going to hear it on BAI. Playwright Edmond Mostyn's name is in small print on the Playbill title page of the new group's loosely based musical adaptation of the French author's classical love story, Cyrano de Bergerac. It's to the credit of adapter-director Erica Schmidt that the soul of Rostand's play remains in her Cyrano at the Darryl Roth Theater. Rostand's scholars and purists, if such animals still exist, might quibble with the liberties taken by Miss Schmidt, because lost is the famous nose speech in Cyrano, but it would be ignoring the appealing aspects of this musical edition. Much of the success must be credited to Peter Dinklage in the title role. Dinklage has achieved international fame for his award-winning performance in the 8 years of Game of Thrones. Is that the title? He's gotten two Emmys from it. But his celebrity is secondary to his theatrical instincts. His diminutive presence serves the playwright's intent, for Cyrano's heart speaks for millions of suitors whose inner poetry challenges the insensitive distinctions determined by the greater society. As you remember, in the original Cyrano, it's his large nose that denies him participation. People judge from cradle to grave because of physical differences, find their voice in Cyrano. If Mr. Dinklage's singing voice is a modest achievement, the songs of Aaron and Bryce Dresner, the music, and Matt Berninger and Karen Besser, who did the lyrics, are best served by Jasmine Cephas Jones as Roxanne. She, by the way, is an alumnus of the original cast of Hamilton. And newcomer Christopher Gurr, who plays Christian, a golden-throated young man of great promise. Cyrano's unrequited love is at the core of this saga, where oddities and coincidence are the stuff of great of grand opera, and it lends itself to musical interludes. The key to the success of any presentation of Cyrano's story is its ability to make an emotional connection with the audience. Mr. Dinklage and his excellent cast, under Mischmidt's assured direction, make this Cyrano a theatrical treasure. Now I'm going to tell you what you can see at the theater and support BAI at the same time. Earlier we announced that we have tickets for the Grand Society. Our guest said she wanted to see that, and you can. And I'm going to, where's my review of it? I'm going to do a little bit of a brush up on my review for late. If you just tuned in, where have you been? You missed all this. The Great Society is Robert Schenken's... I can't find my notes. I'm all over the place. Robert Schenken's play, The Great Society, is about the years of Lyndon Baines Johnson, and it's being presented at the glorious Vivian Beaumont Theater at Lincoln Center, and here I found it. Robert Schenken's political pageant, The Great Society, is igniting the Vivian Beaumont Theater at Lincoln Center. Living through the 1960s was at once exhilarating, treacherous, and transformative, and the audacious Mr. Schenken has miraculously recaptured the conflicts of that volatile decade, all of which continues to resonate today. And there on the stage, you meet LBJ and Wilbur Mills and Martin Luther King and Hubert Humphrey and all of the men. And I say men because practically the only woman that was a factor in this was Lady Bird. But they're all there on stage, and they're dealing with the civil rights movement and King's march on poverty, as well as the war that was emerging and the anti-war protests that were happening. And you see that King was criticized because he took a position against the war and was scolded that he was compromising the civil rights movement, and people not understanding the scope of the King morality. J. Edgar Hoover's in it. These are all characters in this play, The Great Society, at Lincoln Center in the beautiful Vivian Beaumont Theater. We have tickets Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday night this week. Curtain at 7 o'clock, $100 to BAI, and you get two tickets. But you have to call us at 212-209-2950. And we'll be here until 12, and after that, the phone will ring, and it will go, what do they say about computers? It's in the clouds. Mm-hmm. It won't be, you won't hear anybody. So if you want to see the Great Society and support BAI, or if you just want to support BAI, call us now at 212-209-2950. And you can do that to the melodious sound of Nancy Lamont, who's singing a James Taylor classic.
The secret of life is enjoying the passage of time. Any fool can do it. There ain't nothing to it. Nobody knows how we got to the top of the hill. Since we're on our way down, we might as well enjoy the ride. The secret of love is in opening up your heart. It's okay to feel afraid, but don't let that stop. just a smile. Isn't it a lovely ride? Sliding down, gliding down. Try not to try too hard. It's just a lovely ride.
Nancy Lamott here on Friday afternoon, morning, whatever this is. I find it curious. Maybe I'm too close to the story and can't get a proper perspective on it. But the New York Times did a story when the coup took place and BAI was taken off the air. I would think that considering the history of this station, it's which they described in the coup story about the legendary people who were first heard, they always talk about Bob Dylan and Bob Fosse having Dylan on, that you would think that our being back in the air would have warranted some attention in the arts section or in the news section. One of my favorite BAI stories is or legends is one of the fundraisers, and it showed the fanaticism, if you will, of our listeners, or the devotion. Steve, I'm doing a name thing. Steve Post was on during a fundraising drive, and money wasn't coming in sufficiently, and he threatened to play Kate Smith singing When the Moon Comes Over the Mountain until he raised $1,000. Now, by the third playing, you would think that people would have changed the station or turned it off. But BAI people don't know that there are other stations. They are so devoted that they just stayed until he got the $1,000. I know Mike Fader once said that BAI was off, I think, after Fast went off about 2 or 3 in the morning and didn't come on again until 7 o'clock with Larry Josephson. This was when we were over on 39th Street way back, that there was static all night, and that Mike said that, like many listeners, he would put on the radio and listen to the static until Larry Josephson came on, sometimes 10 minutes late, sometimes 20 minutes late, when Larry the Bagel Man would come in and he would have his breakfast while we listened in the morning. That was the BAI that when I discovered BAI in 1966, I had was co-producer of the first anti-war play called Viet Rock. And Arthur Seidelman asked me to come on. It was the only local station that was interested in 1966 in a play with music about the war. And the interesting thing about Viet Rock was it got so much attention because Robert Brustein called me. He had just been made head of the Yale Drama School, and we invited him to a backers audition. And he said he was opening his tenure as dean of the Yale Drama School with a Chekhov play. But after he saw Viet Rock in a backers audition, he decided he wanted to open his duration as dean of the Yale Drama School with our production of Viet Rock. And it opened at Yale and got tremendous attention because it was the opening production at Yale. And I then came on WBAI, the only place that was interested in a play about the war. And then I produced the following year, February of 67, produced Fortune in Men's Eyes, the prison drama, which changed my life. And it was BAI that kept inviting me and people involved with the production to be guests. And at that point, they asked me if I would do a program on criminal justice. And once every week, I would come on. It was called Both Sides of the Bars, and we had a formerly incarcerated man or woman and someone from the system. And that's my BAI pedigree, if you will. And that's all leading up to my saying that I'm going to tell you about two things that we're offering that you will call and give money to BAI and then be enriched with participating in New York City's cultural diversity. The play Confidence and the Speech, we just talked to the playwright. What a fascinating play concept it is about Jimmy Carter, and it's almost revisionist, but not revisionist because there is nothing to revision. There's so little about Carter in our recent history, but Susan Lampert Hayden's play about his speech of confidence and how it lends itself theatrically is a play that starts previews this week. I found her a fascinating interview. We have tickets for it Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night this week on Theater Row at West 42nd Street. If you make a gift of $65 to BAI, and you can call us at 212-209-2950. And then after you've seen that, you can come, if you want to plan ahead, on Sunday, December 8th at 2 o'clock at the Commons here in the People's Republic of Brooklyn, Malachi McCord and moi, that's French for me, are going to have a conversation. We did it last week up at Castle Gardens in Harlem, and we had a sold-out crowd, even with BAI not on the air for us to talk about. So we're inviting you now for Sunday, December 8th, 2 o'clock at the Commons on 388 Atlantic Avenue. It's $25 a person. The money goes to BAI. Call us at 212-209-2950. We receive so many calls and so much concern about us being off the air and what can we do to help. Here's what you can do. Go to the theater and pay us. 212-209-2950. Who do we have? Bobby McFarren. Freedom is a voice. Boy, is that a, that should be a theme song for WBAI. Bobby McFarren, Freedom is a voice. Yeah.
beat us on woman and go not in there. Conquer us and do it in the bed and mutton. Conquer us and do that 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 and do that.
Thank you, Michael. That was Bobby McFerrin. What a nice number that is. I'm gonna give you a book review, I presume, to tell you, and then tell you about some movies that I saw. I had earlier talked about the extraordinary French movie By the Grace of God, which is at the Film Forum, but I want to talk about others. First, a book review. I thought of Downton Abbey while reading Craig Johnson's first-rate saga, Land of Wolves, published by Viking, set mostly in the mountains of Wyoming. It might seem a stretch, but not for me. I mean, a book about taking place in Wyoming, how do you think of Downton Abbey? Well, the New York Times film reviewer recently was critical of the movie version of Downton Abbey, arguing that its characters were elitists living in a dream world of castles and royal visits. But that's why we read and go to the movies, to see places, to sites that you'll never visit, to meet men and women who will never cross our path. I'm never going to be at Downton Abbey. I love the television series, and I love the movie. Let me tell you about Sheriff. Well, first, let me departure on that criticism. One of my favorite movies of all time is Sounder with Cicely Tyson and Paul Winfield, Marty Ritt's signature picture about a black family in the 30s and poor dirt farmers. Now, are they part of my life? Did I know them? Was I there in the 30s? No, but I was introduced to people that I would have not known through the movies. And the same with Downton Abbey. Those were people that I wouldn't know. That's why we read and go to the movies, to enrich ourselves, to find out about people. I thought the Times Review was absurd. So let me tell you about Sheriff Walt Longmire, a highly principled law enforcer in a thinly populated Wyoming county. There's a wolf loose, and an immigrant worker who is a victim of violence. It's not my world at all, nestled as I am in the catacombs of Manhattan. But as you become acquainted with Walt, his cohorts, his aches and his pains, he becomes disarmingly familiar. Author Craig Johnson is new to me, though Land of Wolves is his 15th novel, featuring my new friend Walt Langmire. Think of all the good reading I have ahead of me, catching up on Walt as he moves in and around the big hills of Wyoming. So that's my answer to the Times critic. Now, I saw Harriet, about Harriet Tubman. which is a stunning picture. But the trouble with the difficulty with film biographies like Harriet Tubman is that they're recreating people who lived 150 years ago, and so the dialogue has to be all created, and sometimes it doesn't ring true. That being said, there are scenes in of infinite power, and one of the quietest moments is when Harriet Tubman was born with another name, and when she was transporting slaves, it was suggested to her that she take another name, and she looks into the camera and she simply says, "I'm Harriet Tubman, and you feel all of history when she just says that, and it's fascinating that that quiet moment touched me so much. And there's a scene at the end of the movie when she's going to rescue the slaves to get them on a boat, and you see them come up from behind, they're in the woods, and just see a whole host of people racing towards the boat. It's so dramatic, and there's much to suggest and to celebrate about Harriet. Motherless Brooklyn is Ed Norton's movie, which is about what Robert Moses, it's based on a novel, fictionalized about all the political machinations imposed by Robert Moses, tearing down what Jane Jacobs used to call stoop culture, to build the projects, to build parks that were not accessible to the black population and to poor people, to build Jones Beach, where buses coming from Harlem couldn't get under the tunnels, the overpass, because they were too low for buses to get through, and only suburban people in cars could get to Jones Beach. It's a fascinating story. Ed Norton, who wrote the screenplay, is excellent in the lead. I saw him on an interview on TCM, and he talked about him being influenced by the movie Chinatown. I wish Ed Norton had gotten another director. He wrote the screenplay, he starred in it, and he directed it. And I would have hoped that he would have had another perspective directing it, because at times the multi-faceted plot sort of overflow. And that was clarified to me the day after when I saw Scorsese's The Irishman, when you can see what a brilliant director could do. Now, The Irishman is 3.5 hours. It's playing in – I noticed today in the ad in the Times that it's playing in theaters all over the metropolitan area, not just those three little dinky theaters in Manhattan, but in Brooklyn and Jersey and Long Island Pacino giving a performance incredible as Jimmy Hoffa. De Niro, Joe Pesci, Ray Romano plays a lawyer in it. It's 3.5 hours. I went at 10:30 in the morning. When I came out, I said, oh, it's still daytime. I thought it was so long. But it's a master. Scorsese's a master. And if you read his op-ed piece in the Times about the economic politics of why, you know, it's made by Netflix and the multi what do you call it, the multi-something theaters, the ones that have 8 and 12 theaters in it, AMC and Regal and Cinepolis, wouldn't book it because they wanted it for 8 weeks. And they're sort of dedicated to movies, comic book pictures. And so you had to go to, I sat in the 90-seat IFC theater to see it. But The Irishman is a great movie. We're winding up. We're going to go out with Miss Nancy Lamont, but I want to tell you it's last chance to call us at 212-209-2950 to see The Great Society at Lincoln Center at Vivian Beaumont Theater Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday night this week at 7 o'clock. $100 to BAI. You're supporting us in our internal crisis. You can see Conversations with Malachi McCourt and me on Sunday, December 8th here at the Commons. That's $25 a person. Or The Plague, Confidence, and the Speech about Jimmy Carter, Thursday, Friday, or Saturday this week at $65 for a pair. I'm on tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, my usual time, so I'll be talking to you then. And Nancy, take us to bye-bye land. Nancy Lamont.
Here we are, you and I at last, in the right place at the right time.
every dream I've dreamed has come to pass, 'cause you're right here and you're all mine. I can't believe the years of holding back are through, and I can finally share what's in my heart with you. Listen, listen, listen to my heart, listen to it sing, listen to my voice, it wants to tell you everything. There's so much to say, I don't know where to start, but if you want to know the love I'm feeling, listen to my heart. All my life I've been on a road, going one way toward one dream. The road would wind and down it I would go, always searching, never finding. I'm not waiting anymore.